Very good. All right, so last week when we introduced David and Avshalom, which we're going to be learning Ritz Hashem for the next few weeks. So we set up last week really focusing on the personality of Avshalom and how it can be that Avshalom would be somebody who would get into this rebellion. This week we're going to really focus more on David, although at the end of this year we'll see some more about Avshalom. And we focused on last week was the parallels that the Navi really goes out of its way to draw between Amnon, Tamar, and then Yaakov, and then David HaMelech, with Yaakov Avinu and his two children, Dina and Yosef. And the perspective we were trying to draw about Avshalom was really similar to the way that Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig explains what's happening with the Shimon and Levi in the story of Dina and Shechem, where both Shimon and Levi and Avshalom use exceptionally moral language and are really, ethical, and they're outraged and they're perpetrating violence, but they're doing it for extremely principled reasons. However, you have to wonder if the reasons that they're giving are the reasons that are really motivating them. And while at first glance, you read the story and it seems like Amnon is the son who's just a total low life, and Avshalom seems to come off as a more sympathetic figure, you know, avenging and defending his sister. As we reflect and we looked really carefully at the words that Avshalom said to Tamar, and we realized there was a much, much, much more troubling personality under the surface, and that Avshalom and Amnon really had much more in common in certain ways than they had, in difference. Both are two different examples of evil. Amnon, who was just completely enslaved to his pursuit of pleasure, and it didn't matter what that did to Tamar, it didn't matter what that did to Amnon. He was going to do what his Yetzer Hara wanted him to do, and then we saw some of the failed tshuva reactions to that afterwards, while Avshalom, he, from the get-go, has a singular obsession, not with pleasure, but with power. This is somebody who wants power. This is somebody who realizes he has charisma, who has skill, who has talent, and wants to be king. And from the get-go, he's using what Amnon has done as a political opportunity. His pursuit of revenge, his murder of Amnon, which he almost convinces himself is being done out of real moral principled reaction. Belying that, we saw, he wasn't really out there. His primary reaction to what Amnon did was not, what happened to my sister. It's what happened to me. It's the revenge that I need to take. We just have basically one son who's an example of Gilei Raios, another son who's an example of Shvichas Damim, right? Two of the big three in terms of the most severe sins in Yiddishkeit. So, we left off with Avshalom as a fugitive. In the parak, the next parak, we're going to really shift to David. And we're going to see, either we know the Avshalom personality, the narcissistic, power-obsessed, whatever it takes to be king personality of Avshalom. So we can see how he can get into this situation. So from David's behavior, this parak, we'll think, see how David could allow things to get into this situation. I think the theme of the story is going to be the permission structures that we can create for ourselves, how we can, good people, in David's case, David HaMelech, can rationalize doing the things that we want to do anyway, which is kind of similar to Avshalom. Avshalom is, murdering Amnon, telling himself he was doing it for very good reasons. We're going to see the permission structure that David is going to set up and the disaster that that's going to lead to this week. So Avshalom is on the run. And then right away, the Navi tells us something very mysterious. After 3 years of Avshalom being on the run, so the Navi tells us, "Vayeda Yoav ben Tzruya ki lev hamelach al Avshalom." So Yoav ben Tzruya sees that the heart of the king is on Avshalom. It's a little bit unclear what that means. We'll hear the second what Abarbanel is going to say. But first glance, it sounds like you hear about the heart of the king, and it sounds like the Navi is telling us that Yoav realizes that David's heart is now yearning for Avshalom. That seems to be the way over here that I see the 1917 JPS translated it, right? His heart was toward Avshalom. The previous pasuk told us that David has gotten over the death of Amnon. Now he wants to move on. Now he misses Avshalom. So Yoav is going to send to Tekoa for this exceptionally wise woman, and is going to give her this whole story to try to bring Avshalom back. So we're going to look in depth at the story, but the main question we need to ask from the get-go is, why is Yoav so invested in bringing Avshalom back? Right. What is in it for Yoav? One answer that's commonly given, I think especially among the more modern scholarship and some of the modern Mefarshim as well, is that Yoav is playing a political game over here. Yoav knows that Avshalom is a talented, charismatic, potential leader. And he realizes that he should be, get on Avshalom's good side. Just like, for example, I think the Robert Alter, translation of Sefer Shmuel, that's how he reads the story. It's Yoav being political. There's an obvious problem with that, though. I'll scroll down the source sheet for a second to the end of the parak, which makes it basically impossible to argue that Yoav is doing this because politically he wants to get on Avshalom's good side, which is what, at the end, after Avshalom gets back to Yerushalayim, the Navi is going to tell us that he spends 2 years in Yerushalayim and he never sees the king. And then Avshalom is going to send to Yoav to try to get him an audience with David. And the Navi is going to tell us, "V'lo avalavo elav, v'yishlach od shinis v'lo avalavo." Twice, Avshalom tries to get Yoav to intercede, to get him an audience with David. Hey, Yoav, you did so much to get me into Yerushalayim. You got me, to the 2-yard line. Why can't you get me the audience with David? And Yoav now doesn't do anything. Yoav doesn't even answer his phone calls. So, and that's going to get Avshalom furious, and we'll see what happens at the end of the parak. But in light of the fact that Yoav ignores Avshalom once he actually gets him into the city, it's almost impossible to suggest that what's motivating Yoav here is a desire to get on Avshalom's good side. So if that option is off the table, you need to ask, why does Yoav care? Why is he so invested? Okay, put that question up. Now, regarding the question of what exactly did Yoav see when he leave Hamelech al Avshalom, so there's a very important machlokas between the Abarbanel and the Metzudas Tavit. I think we're going to read the parak the way Metzudas Tavit does. I think it's closer to the pshat, and I think it unlocks a pretty deep message that the parak is having for us. Abarbanel understands that David was still angry with Avshalom. He says, what does it mean that his heart was towards Avshalom? That his heart was bent towards vengeance. He's wanted to get Avshalom punished for 3 years for murdering Amnon. Has not been successful, and he still wants revenge. Says Abarbanel, Ratzon Alomar, Shahayli Boli Nakim Mimenu. For 3 years, he's wanted revenge. Now, Abarbanel understands that David, it's starting to ebb, because I'll scroll up for a second. Earlier, the Navi said, Vatachal David Amelach Latzis El Avshalom. David stopped going out towards Avshalom. So he spends 3 years trying to get Avshalom extradited. He gives up on that, but the way the Abarbanel reads it is, despite the fact that David has stopped trying to actively extradite Avshalom back for punishment, he still has lingering anger and fury at Avshalom. And therefore, Yoav wants David to get over that. He doesn't think it's a good way for David to be thinking. Right, gotta bring in this woman to get David over. Now, a great strength to Abarbanel's argument that Yoav is trying to get David, who is still angry with Avshalom, to forgive him, is why does Yoav have to go into a whole subterfuge? Why does he have to go and bring in this woman from Tekoa and give her a whole story to tell the king? There's gonna be a whole mashal. She's going to come with a whole song and dance about a son of hers who was murdered, and it's going to be a whole fake court case to get David to acquit her son, and then that's going to be the nimshal, the mashal, to acquit Avshalom. It's going to be nimshal. Who cares? Just get in a room with David. Tell David, move on, get over it. Okay. Avshalom had reasons to do what he did. Get him back into Yerushalayim. Let's go. You know, if there's one person in the world who is not afraid to have uncomfortable conversations with David HaMelech, it's Yoav ben Tzruya. He's done it before. He's going to do it again. He's not afraid of that normally. So Barbanel says that's exactly why we have to read the story here, that David is furious with Avshalom. And since Yoav is still afraid of that, he is afraid of David's lasting fury. He's so angry with Avshalom that even Yoav is nervous about it. And in order to get David to move past it, he's going to have to go through a whole subterfuge. That is the way that Abarbanel reads the parashah. But Matudas David says, no, read the pasuk more along the simple words of the pasuk. Leiv HaMelech al Avshalom. Ihir b'hamelech asher libo tov al Avshalom. Yoav senses that David has thought. After 3 years, David has moved on from Amnon, you know, rotten person that he was, and David, and Yoav realizes that David wants to bring Avshalom back. So now the question is, what Abarbanel was asking, okay, if David, you know, yearns for Avshalom, he's forgiven him, he wants to bring him back, so why can't Yoav get into the room with David and say, David, it's time, let's go, you know, here are the plane tickets, get Avshalom back to Yerushalayim. And the answer to that is going to be that David needs to be given the permission structure to bring Avshalom back. On the one hand, David personally wants Avshalom back. On the other hand, that seems to be a miscarriage of justice. David is responsible for Tzedek and Mishpat. That's the job of the king. And how can the king just ignore the fact that somebody committed murder just because that somebody is his son who he wants back in Yerushalayim? That is the conundrum which is tearing David apart, what he wants versus the responsibility that he feels that he has. And I think he's correct in that responsibility. And Yoav is going to create the mashal to give David the permission to do what it is that he wants to do. So let's see how that's going to happen. So the Navi tells us that Yoav brings this woman from Tekoa, and he says, here's the plan. Now, Yoav is a genius. You know, it's not just that he's a general. It's not just that he is a skilled politician and a skilled leader of men. You know, he's also exceptionally insightful into people. So he tells the woman, right, you're going to mourn. You're going to dress up as a mourner. Don't put on oil, right, as if you've been mourning for many days. You're going to come to the king. And he gives this woman the basic story. Now, the woman had to be Isha Chachama because Yoav can give her the screenplay, but, you know, there's a reason why they pay actors a lot of money, right? Anybody can write the screenplay, but you still need the actor to, between pulling it off and adding their own Nofach Mishalahem to really bring it to life and make it convincing, you need the Isha Chachama to actually, really pull it off. So, let's see what she's going to do. So Navi tells us the woman comes, so even the way the Navi just tells us what happens at the beginning, it sounds redundant, right? Let's read it more carefully. She told him. And then she falls on her face. Well, wait, what did she tell him? She tells him, and then she falls on her face and bows down. So it sounds like what the Navi is trying to capture for us is she opens up her mouth to speak, but, you know, and then nothing comes out. She's so agitated that she's trying to get the words out of her mouth. Obviously, it's all an act, but she's trying to get the words out of her mouth. Nothing comes out. Then she just, in desperation, falls down on her face, and she just cries out, Hoshia HaMelech, right? Save me, king. So off the bat, she is doing an amazing job of presenting as a desperate and emotionally completely distraught woman. Okay, so that gets the king's attention. He tells her Malach, and then she gives this fascinating story. Batomer, aval isha almana ani, right? However, I am a widowed woman, Vayamas Ishi, and my husband has died. So there's a lot of redundancy over there. Yeah. All she needed to say was Almana Ani. If she's a widow, then by definition, she's an Isha. And by definition, her husband has died. Right? So she's presenting her whole, she's opening up, you see, by just coming off as so desperately in need, right? She's emphasizing her own vulnerability. She doesn't just say, I'm a widow, right? I'm a widowed woman and my husband is dead. It's like saying, I'm widowed, help, right? You have the, you know, the Yasom and the Almana, that is me. Okay. And then she says, what happened? She had two sons. They fought in the field. Nobody was there. We'll see why the details are important in a second. We'll see what Barbanel has to say. One of them hit the other. And one killed the other. Okay. Give over the son who struck his brother. We'll kill him, right? This is going to be Gol Hadam. We're going to destroy the heir. They're going to destroy my only surviving ember. They're going to wipe out the last name of my husband. So this widow, she's already lost her husband. Now she's lost one son, and the relatives want to kill the other son. So what's the ask from the king, and why is she coming to the king? This is not a Sanhedrin case. Because the Beis Din, right, you want straight halacha, you go to the Beis Din. She's coming to the king because you go to the king when you need justice, which is beyond the letter of the law. So she's saying, look, I mean, I'm desperate. I have nobody. I'll be left with no husband and no sons. And of course, she also, you know, mixes in the fact that the people, the relatives here are not really so enthusiastic about the mitzvah of Gol Hadam. What's really driving them is Nashvida Gamas Hayoresh. If they can, you know, erase the last heir, then they're motivated by the money that they're going to inherit. So she's creating a story where the din is very straightforward. Nefesh tachas nefesh. The Gol Hadam is supposed to kill the murderer. Sounds like it's intentional murder. Cut and dry case. On the other hand, though, you put in all the other factors of her vulnerability and that they're really motivated by the hope for financial gain, and that makes things more complicated. Okay. We'll look at Abarbanel in a minute, how he's going to really pick apart all the messages that are behind this mashal. So David first says, L'chi l'beiseich v'ani asava alayach, go home and I'll take care of things. It's not enough for her. She says, "Alai adni amelach ha'avon, the sin can be upon me." In other words, she's aware that she's asking David to deviate from the din. And she's saying, I'll accept whatever responsibility there is for that. V'hamelach v'chison naki. So she's trying to push David to give a ruling which is not in accordance with the strict din. And she's trying to create the permission for him to do that. I'll take the blame. So David says, okay, anybody who bothers you, send them to me. That's still not enough. Then she pulls out all the stops. So now she invokes the shame Hashem. Right. You don't want the Gol Hadam to destroy. Rashi says, hey, there's a reason why the Torah has us put Ari Miklat all over Eretz Yisrael. Hashem does not want the Gol Hadam to kill the murderer. That happens to be a Machlokas Tanayim, whether in a case of Shogi, the Gol Hadam has a mitzvah, or whether the Gol Hadam has a Rishus. But it's a bit of a slippery move by the woman, because it doesn't seem like we're dealing with the case of Shogi. Seems like we're dealing with a case of mazing. But third time is the charm. Between all the efforts that she's put in and between invoking Shem Hashem and presenting this course of action as what Hashem wants David to do, it finally does the trick. Vayomer chai Hashem yipol misaras panech arz. So David swears in the name of Hashem. Now this is the from thing to do. We always think that we're doing is the from thing to do. That you know, if no one's going to harm a hair of your child's head. Okay, so that's the mashal. Right, trying to get David to go different from the letter of the law. I think when we learned about David and Uri and Bathsheba, we pointed out that there are three times in Tanakh that we have one of these king and a justice case. And each time, the question the king has is, should he go with the din or should he deviate from the din? And each time he messes up, right? And last time was David going all in on the rich man who took the sheep from the poor man, and that didn't work out so well for David. So the same thing is going to happen over here. He deviates from the din, you can understand why, and he wants rachamim. Now, Abarbanel says, let's understand all the messages behind this mashal. So Abarbanel says that there are four pieces in here which are supposed to parallel the Avshalom's murder of Amnon, and they are supposed to minimize the severity of what Avshalom did. So number one, says Abarbanel, what was the case? So Vayinutzu Shnehem Basadeh. Why is it so important that it was just the two of them in the field? So Abarbanel says, well, there were no witnesses out in the field by themselves. There was no warning out in the field and by themselves. So the technical halacha should be it shouldn't be a capital crime. No witnesses, no warning, no capital crime. Now, you open up the Rambam, that's not really totally true. That happens to be that's exactly the king's job. Is to kill murderers when we have like a problem like no hasra and the bezdin can't take care of it. But the technical halacha for a classic Sanhedrin is that they're not supposed to take action in such a case. So hey, says Abarbanel, that is exactly what happened with Amnon and Avshalom. It happened at the shearing party. There was no warning. Right? The assassins came on to Amnon right away. Avshalom never had a warning. So that's piece number one. Okay, piece number two. The woman said in the Mashal, Ein Matzil Beneihem. It was the two of them out in the fields, and there was no one else out there to save the brother who was killed by the other brother. So Barbanel says, well, hold on a second. There was no third party to bring peace between the two. Says that is a hint of Musar to David. Amra Zeller Mosle David, Shekasher Amnon Inaz Tamar, Lo Yiser Oso Karaui. David was supposed to be the third party. David was supposed to be the matzil. He saw what happened. He was furious with Amnon, but he didn't do a darn thing. He just sat there on the side and let Amnon just sit. Now we saw Barbanel quote the fast day medrash that Amnon goes to yeshiva for 2 years. So, you know, he's going to learn as a way to do tshuva. David didn't do anything. So Barbanel says that's the second piece of the mashal. Ein matzil b'nehem, there was no third party who could have brought peace between them. And that was David's mistake. The third ingredient to the mashal, he says, she described the story in a funny way. Vayaku ha'echad es ha'echad vayamasav so. One hit one, and he killed him. Now, my English teacher would not like that sentence because it's not clear who's doing what to who, right? A pronoun confusion over here, right? Who's the one hitting the other? So Barbanel explains that actually one brother, you know, brother A hit brother B, then brother B killed brother A. He started it. It's the old he started it defense. So Barbanel says that's exactly what happened here as well. Amnon started the whole thing. Amnon raped Tamar. And nothing happened to him. That was a provoked Avshalom. It wasn't that Avshalom was the aggressor. Amnon was the one who made the first move. And that's why it's really he deserves what he got. I mean, come on, everyone reads last week's story, and nobody comes out of last week feeling bad for Amnon. Everyone reads the story saying Amnon deserved what he got. You know, everyone reads the story of Shechem, and they say Shechem and Hamor deserved what they got. The rest of the city, much more complicated. But those two, yeah, no one's feeling bad for them. Demo Barasho, absolutely, no problem. Finally, piece number four, what is the deal with the whole family? So this is really, really interesting, because here Barbanel opens up the politics of what's going on. Right, we suggested last week that one of Avshalom's major motivations here is he sees this as a chance to get Amnon who should be the crown prince, out of his way. Well, Abravanel says, let's think about all of the other brothers. Now that Avshalom is the next brother in line. So it says, well, all those relatives wanted the brother killed because they wanted, they were running for the money. Right? So it wasn't because they really were so motivated by the mitzvah gal adam. He's supposed to inherit the whole estate and they can knock him off. They can make a lot of money. So Barbanel says, what was the parallel? All the other princes, what are they saying to David all day long? Anytime David goes out for lunch with one of his sons, he goes out for dinner with his sons, what's the first thing they say? Hey, David, you know, did you kill Avshalom yet? We can't let him get back in. Oh, right, they're very, very principled. We can't possibly forgive Avshalom what he did to his brother. We care very, very, very much about brother. You know, they didn't lift a finger when Amnon assaulted Tamar. But now all of a sudden, they're very principled. We can't possibly forgive one brother for what he did to another. We got to get rid of him. David, he's got to kill Avshalom. Avshalom was the oldest of the surviving brothers. We know Na'ah le'adnus. His personality is very fitting for rulership. And no one denies that Avshalom has leadership potential. So he's old enough. He has a personality to do it. Right, so that's the other message to David, is all these people who are telling you that you have to punish Avshalom, they are only being motivated by political aspirations. So you put all of it together, and it's twisting the din, but it is intended to give David the ability to rationalize to himself why he should allow Avshalom back into Yerushalayim. Right? And I think the way to understand this, what should be the psak for this woman? I don't know, man. I'm not a Yachid Mumche judge. You need like a Shlomo HaMelech to be able to judge a case like this. It's brilliantly calibrated by Yoav to be as... you couldn't come up with a better case of let's ignore the formal halacha if we try, right? And then at the same time, drawing the parallel to this case to allow David to use that mashal to hear, rationalize what he wants to do. Barbanel also points out that we can't miss the Bracious parallel over here. So there's no question that this is strikingly similar to the story of Cain and Hevel. And just like despite everything that Adam suffered, he never punished Cain. So too, David HaMelech should not punish Avshalom. Leave it up to Ribbono Shel Olam. Adam leaves it up to Ribbono Shel Olam how to deal with Cain. David should leave it up to Ribbono Shel Olam what to do with Avshalom. What person could decide how to judge such a difficult, complicated case over here? On the one hand, Avshalom committed murder. On the other hand, there are so many extenuating circumstances as we've surveyed. So leave it on the side, bring him back, show rachamim, and let Hashem do what he wants to do. Right, now, once David says exactly what we're looking for, to let the son survive. So now it's time for the woman to break character. Now she goes from being so exceptionally smooth and compelling and convincing to the moment kind of gets her. And the words that she says kind of don't make a lot of sense. So we're not going to spend so much time going through the details. But all of a sudden she just goes into like meandering, very nervous, whole long speech. And of course, the key point here is that David should forgive Avshalom. So David realizes what's going on, and right away he sees, you know, the one thing we say about David, David's also a smart man, and he says, "Did Yoav put you up to this?" Hayad Yoav itach b'chol zos. Atani shava atom rachein avshcha adni ha-melech, yimish yimin la'asmil, b'chol ashi d'ber adni ha-melech, yavdcha Yoav hu tzivani. Who some of Fisha Fasla is called Rama Ela, right? This all came from Yoav. Now, Yoav is standing right there, right? Let's see. Let's go to the next pasuk. Yoav is watching the entire time. And the king tells that Yoav, okay, you got it. You got exactly what you want. Yoav bows down. Yoav gives a bracha to the king. And Yoav does exactly that. He goes and brings Avshalom back. But I don't think that Yoav thought he was risking the life of this woman. Right? The way Abarbanel reads the story, I mean, Yoav might be really putting this woman's life in danger if David is so furious with Avshalom, right? I don't think Yoav was doing that at all. He's trying to give David permission to do what he wants to do all along. Now, okay, now we know what's going on with David. And that's the weakness of David. That's how the Yetzer Hara can work on us. And that mistake, right, that giving in, that rationalization is going to create all of the problems for David. All the punishment that David is going to get, right, it's going to be self-imposed. It's all going to come from this one fateful moment. Right? Hashem makes it so that David is almost the author of his own punishment, right? This is not Makos. We're not bringing in, you know, Barad and Arba. David's own weakness, David's own inability, you know, once again, to stand up and do what has to be done, no matter how hard it is going to be what is going to bring about his own punishment. Right? It's really, really interesting how Hashem does that. And we're going to see, I think that's going to happen next week as well. Now you need to ask, okay, so we have a pretty good picture by now of Avshalom. We have a sense of Avshalom as just a power-hungry narcissist who is convinced of his own perfection, is willing to do whatever it takes. We have the sense of David, who on the one hand is still torn by guilt and paralyzed by what happened with Uri and Bathsheba, as we saw last week. And at the same time, just there's this very understandable, maybe it could be universal, weakness that we just saw, where he's convinced to do what he wanted to do and thinking that's the right thing. But the third person who's the real major player in the whole story, Yoav, right, who's really going to be the hero going forward in many ways, but what is in it for Yoav? Now let's ask this question. What is in it for Yoav? It is clearly not political, getting on Avshalom's good side, as we saw. It's clearly not that he's wowed and taken by Avshalom. Avshalom can use his charisma to manipulate so many people. Yoav ben Tsruya is not somebody who gets moved and manipulated. You know, that's not how he works. So I think the simplest way to understand what's in it for Yoav is Yoav and Avshalom find themselves in strikingly similar situations. Because before Avshalom committed an act of politically convenient Goel Hadam killing, Yoav did the exact same thing. In the beginning of Shmuel Beis, when Avner kills Yoav's brother Asael in combat in very sketchy circumstances, you know, the Gemara talks at length about it. And Yoav, the way the Gemara described the ultimate Din Torah, that Yoav has a Shlomo HaMelech, and you know, Yoav is both smart enough and compelling enough that he's able to beat Shlomo in a Din Torah. Now, not everybody can take on the smartest man in history in a Din Torah and win, but Yoav is able to get himself acquitted in Shlomo's Din Torah for killing Avner. He's able to get himself acquitted as the Goel Hadam, which the Navi I think emphasizes twice in the Sukkim, right? The Navi tells us that Yoav assassinates Avner Bidam Asael Achiv, and tells us again in Pasuk Lamed over there that Yoav killed Avner Al Asher Himesis Asael Achihem B'Givon B'Melchama, because he killed their brother. But at the same time, there can be no doubt that Yoav also found murdering Avner awfully convenient politically, because this was at the time when Avner and David are finishing their negotiations to reunite the house of David and the house of Shaul. The logical next step would be for Avner to come in as the head of David's army. Yoav does not want that to happen, partially because he doesn't trust Avner. He seems to genuinely not trust Avner, but we can't deny that Yoav really wants to be the general himself. And all of the really good reasons that Yoav can tell David, can tell Shlomo, can tell himself for why he's killing Avner underlying them is the reality that he wants to be the general, right? He could be absolutely correct in terms of all the good reasons he has to do what he does. But at the end of the day, there was at least a selfish motivation, if not the primary reason for it, definitely a reason for that. David never forgives Yoav. Yoav knows this. David doesn't have a choice. He has to keep Yoav as general. He's too valuable and too powerful for David to do anything about. Now, Yoav sees his chance because Avshalom has just done exactly the same thing. He's just killed Amnon. For all intents and purposes, Avshalom is the Goel Hadam for his sister Tamar. So Yoav now has a chance. If he can get David to forgive Avshalom, then David has no choice but to finally forgive Yoav as well. You can't have it both ways. He can't at the same time allow Avshalom back after he took revenge on Amnon while still maintaining distance and anger towards Yoav for what he did to Avram. So that, I think, is the simplest read of what's in it for Yoav. So what we have then is we have Yoav who's acting brilliantly, but ultimately acting selfishly. We have David, who's acting the way he wants to, while convincing himself with a lot of help that this is the right thing to do. And that's going to be the road, ultimately, to disaster. That is going to be the road to civil war and to David losing the throne and to Yoav having to go with him in exile. All of the selfishness and mistakes in this parak over here, as understandable as they are, right? That's so important to get across. These are not, you know, like, you're not shaking your head saying, how could they do this? It's dafka the understandable mistakes from great people that are the ones that are ultimately going to get them in trouble. So now, last couple minutes left, let's end the parak, and now we will shift from David and Yoav back to one more really important insight the Navi gives us into the personality of Avshalom. Right, so Avshalom, or actually two really important insights into Avshalom. Avshalom is not welcome, as we saw, right? David will let him back in, but we could tell that David is still really wrestling, really uncomfortable with what's been done over here. So he's going to find some compromise for himself. He'll bring Avshalom back to Yerushalayim, but he's not going to be close with him. Fanai lo yireh, he's not going to see my face. David is he's in an impossible position, but he's still trying to find some balance. But you can tell that something's eating at him. He knows that this is not right. He knows bringing Avshalom back and just forgiving him is not right. And so he's just trying to find a compromise, which is only going to make things worse. Now the Navi tells us that Avshalom was exceptionally beautiful. All right, not just exceptionally beautiful. Lo haya ish yafeh b'chol Yisrael lahalel ma'od. Right, so extraordinarily praiseworthy in his beauty. He didn't have a single blemish. And then the Navi talks about his hair. You know, Chazal describe Avshalom as a Nazir, which is really a perfect presentation of Avshalom. Now, why are you a Nazir? Well, we're going to take the long locks, which Avshalom loves to grow because of his beauty, and we're going to dress it up in religious garb. We're going to make it seem religiously impressive, when underlying that are much more selfish motivations. That's the consistent MO of Avshalom. And it's also just an interesting note. This is a theme we have throughout Sefer Shmuel. The Navi again and again and again introduces people to us who have one particularly extraordinary talent, but so often that talent ends up either not helping them or just being their downfall. Shaul with his height and Goliath with his size, and Naval with his money, Asael, the brother of Yoav and Avishai with his speed, which ends up with him running top speed into Avner's spear, getting himself killed. Batsheva with his beauty, Yonadav, right, with the buddy last week of Amnon, who's exceptionally smart, but his brains just came to come up with a plan which led to disaster. You know, again and again and again, the Navi tells us, we all get our talents from Ribono Shel Olam, but the question is not, what our talents are does not define us. No, it's what we do with those talents. Because again and again and again, every person who has a particularly outstanding trait in the Sefer, it ends up being used for bad, or it ends up, you know, collapsing on them. So that is definitely the case with Avshalom, who has this amazing beauty, but A, he's just going to use it to manipulate people into doing what he wants. And of course, at the end of his life, you know, that thick hair is going to kill him when he gets trapped in the tree. But the parak concludes with Avshalom spending 2 years, can't see the king. And this is terrible. This is a total disaster. Because what was Avshalom's plan? Avshalom should be the crown prince. So now he's back in Yerushalayim. But if David won't forgive him, if he can't get an audience with the king, then what's the point? So he's desperate to get back in with David HaMelech. What does he do? He does something insane. Right? The barley in Yoav's field is ripening, burning, right? Hasisua ba'esh. And they do so. It's the second time we see Avshalom's persuasive power. He's able to convince his avadim. Last week, he had his avadim kill the prince. This week, he has his avadim burn the field of Yoav. Now, if there's one man in all of Israel that you do not want to make enemies with, it is Yoav ben Tzruya, right? It's the man who David HaMelech said, "I can't handle these sons of Tzruya. These are real tough guys." You know, and we're going to see Yoav ultimately is in a different league from Avshalom. Avshalom thinks of himself as a leader and as a hard man. Oh, he's got nothing on Yoav at all. You don't burn Yoav's field, but Avshalom does it. Yoav can't believe it. And in the short term, it works. Yoav comes to Avshalom and says, "Why do you do that?" And Avshalom says, "Well, you know, you wouldn't give me an audience with David." So it works in the short term. Yoav goes to the king and he intercedes on Avshalom's behalf, and it's effective. David does allow Avshalom back in, although we'll look what happens there in a second. It's not exactly what Avshalom wants. But it is such incredible short-term thinking from Avshalom. It's a gangster mentality already, right? It works because it's like Richard Nixon, you know, they let them think you're crazy. If this guy, Avshalom, can burn my field, I have no idea what he's going to do next. It is insane for him to burn my field. Yoav, the killer, the general, the head of the exceptionally loyal army, well, if he killed the crown prince and now he burned my field, I have no idea. This is a person who is out of control, and Yoav is just going to accommodate, right? However, that's effective in the short term. But Avshalom, for all of his charisma and for all of his plotting, Avshalom is not at all a man of strategy. And you do not burn your bridges. You do not make enemies with somebody like Yoav ben Tzruya. And while this works for him now, here in Perek Tesvav, he now has made a lasting enemy of the most dangerous person in the country. And Yoav, spoiler alert, is going to be the one to kill Avshalom in Perek Yutes. So then we're fleshing out this, you know, Avshalom personality sketch. He's a man who is so desperate for power and so narcissistic and so convinced of his own talents, there's no limit on what he's willing to do. Right? Even beyond, he'll do things which are extraordinarily risky. But he doesn't, it's like a spoiled child. I need an audience of the king, and I'll do whatever it takes to get that. And we can't deny that Avshalom has guts. It took guts to kill the crown prince. It takes guts to kill, to burn the field of Yoav. You know, there's no denying his guts. You always have to ask, is it courage or is it stupidity? And what happens here with Yoav kind of veers into that territory. But, you know, we'll just close. This will set up for next week. So finally, Avshalom gets that audience. But the Malbim has a very, very important point. So let's read it inside. So, Vayikra el Avshalom, Vayavu el Hamelech. Avshalom comes to the king. You don't have to read that full passage. Vayavu Yoav el Hamelech. He comes to the king. Vayagid lo. Vayikra el Avshalom, Vayavu el Hamelech. Avshalom comes to the king. Vayishtach lo al parvaritza lifnei Hamelech. Vayishak Hamelech la Avshalom. How many times do we see the word king in that passage? 1, 2, 3, 4. David, in his dealings with Avshalom here, is only the Melech. He's never David, right? And the Malbim points out that the kiss that's here is not a kiss of friendship. It's like a formal, you know, kind of, you know, on the side, the cheeks or on the forehead. It's a formal kiss. There's no emotional connection over here. The Malbim quotes the Ibn Ezra, who says that when you see Nishika with a lamid, so that is a kiss, he says, that's like on the hand or on the shoulder. No, it's not a kiss on the mouth. Vayishak Avshalom would have been a real kiss. Vayishak Li Avshalom, he kisses to him, right? So that is a kiss of distance. It's a formal audience. David gives it to Avshalom, he lets him back in, but the relationship is not going to be repaired. David is just totally torn, and David is not going to allow himself to fully reconnect with Avshalom. And Avshalom is going to notice that. He's going to notice, as the Malbim says, Lo nashakov so bepekhara oy leben habachor hamolech tachtav. This is not the reception of the kiss that will be given to the crown prince, oldest firstborn son who's surviving now. Rak nashak lo bigufo is a formal kiss on the body. And so Avshalom now realizes at the end of the parak, he's done everything he had to do to get himself in position to be the crown prince. Amnon is gone. And he waited, and he was willing to wait and wait and wait. And now he gets back into Yerushalayim. And then he did what he had to do, as radical as it was, to get the audience back with David. But now there's nothing left. He has no cards left to play. David is not going to recognize Avshalom as the crown prince. He's done everything he can. He's exhausted that avenue to get himself promoted to be crown prince. We end the parak, and Avshalom realizes it's not going to happen. And that is why, in the next parak, he's going to have to shift to plan B. Because the thing that Avshalom needs more than anything else is he wants to be king. And if he's not going to be made king by David, then he's going to rebel, right? There's somebody who knows absolutely no limits on getting what he wants. And the irony is that it was David doing what he wants by bringing Avshalom back that's going to put Avshalom into that position. So, any thoughts left here, but otherwise we'll stop.
Oh,
yeah, great.
Just one question, and maybe I'm reading into it too much, but if we go back to towards the beginning of the parak, when David says to Yoav, Lech Hashiv et Hana'ar, and he doesn't say like Lishloach Hana'ar, like Lehavi et Hana'ar, meaning to bring him back. He uses the word like the Shoresh of coming back or returning. So could that connote that maybe there is something about that, like his anchor really is Yerushalayim and he really does belong here, and showcase David's ambivalence towards it? Because like, it doesn't seem like such a cold word as in like the removed kiss. It seems more like bring him home.
Are you talking at the...
When Yoav, sorry, after the woman gives her mashal and her nimshal, and then David confronts Yoav, doesn't he say like, Lech Hashev Atana'ar?
Oh, to return him to Yerushalayim.
Right. So I'm saying like, yeah, the word like Lahashi versus Lahavi or La Lacha, like, does that connote some sense of warmth or some sense of belonging?
It could. I'm not sure. But even if it does, because we're setting up that David's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Right.
Because he's trying to bring Avshalom back while, you know, he's like trying to feed his Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara at the same time. Right.
Right.
Yeah. We're going to bring Avshalom back, but I'm still going to hold the grudge.
Right, right, okay. Right, okay, yeah. Perfect. Thank you. Right.
Okay, yeah, Shakach. All right, have a wonderful Lag BaOmer. See you next week.
Thank you.
Bye.